This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Our Master Cheesemaker program is one of the only two in the world. So it's no wonder every master in America has called Wisconsin home. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Cerise Zelenets. We'll talk to Cerise about art, wine, and her new natural wine bar. We will taste a special cuvée made for Cerise's new bar by Joe Swick. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Vermont-born Cerise Zelenets headed to Paris after high school to study at the Parsons School of Design. She stayed in Paris for a while and also did a residency in Spain before returning to New York. Cerise makes jewelry, clothing, and is a prolific illustrator. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Paris Review, Nylon Magazine, to name a few, and has designed menus and wine labels for numerous clients. Cerise recently published her first book, The Sound of Scrambled Eggs. So, the question is, with all that going on, why did she open a natural wine bar? I guess we're going to find out. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Cerise. Thank you for coming in. All right, so we're talking to Cerise live. We're at the Heritage Radio Network Studios at Roberta's in Bushwick. Cerise's new wine bar is not far from around the corner. All right, Cerise, a lot of people may have come across you through your work, your illustrations, New Yorker, that ain't no chump magazine, some of your jewelry, clothing, art, and all of that. So they may have seen that, but I'm not sure they know much about you. So give me a little background on your life in art, wine, and life that got you to where we are today, which is about a month into a new wine bar.
All right. So,
Big question.
So from the beginning, I was born and raised in Vermont, small town. My parents are both New Yorkers. I ended up spending a lot of time in the city as a kid.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
New Yorkers, why did they go to Vermont?
They were both language teachers, and they went to the School for International Training and decided to raise my sister and I in the countryside.
Okay. So that's how you got there.
That's how I got
there. Grew up there. Continue.
Grew up there. Went to a hippie high school on a farm. Ended up getting very into art and fashion. And then straight after, decided to move to Paris. Maybe it's because my parents gave me a French name, but I developed this love for French culture and ended up getting into the Parsons program there. So I moved straight out of high school, studied fashion and fine art for 2 years there, and then came back to New York to finish the Parsons program and graduated in menswear. Did that for a little bit, decided that industry wasn't really for me, did copywriting for a little bit.
The industry or menswear in that industry?
Just fashion, design. There was a lot of just unfulfillment for me in the process of your idea and what actually materializes from it. So I moved into copywriting just because I found this opportunity at a company that I liked and got more into writing in general. I've always loved words and worked with words in my art, but yeah, did that for a while. Realized anything in the fashion industry wasn't for me, and I just quit.
And 4 years of Parsons down the
toilet. 4 years of Parsons, I know.
Not really, but go ahead.
Don't know what I'm doing now. But yeah, I mean, I quit. Didn't know what I was going to do. I just started drawing again because I had always loved it. Started posting drawings and paintings, and it turned into a sort of career where people started asking me to do illustration for them.
Organically?
Yeah.
Just people you knew and they would see stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I was posting on Instagram and okay. My first...
Social media.
Social media. My first big illustration project was this model agency asked me to do all of their show cards for them. So I did like 20 portraits. And then, yeah, just a lot of outreach, building client base, working with new people, branding. And
just for context, when was that? How long back are we talking?
This was like 4 years ago.
Okay, not that long
ago. Not that long ago, yeah. Seems like a long time to me, but... but yeah, so I was doing illustration, and I started bartending on the side just because I was working by myself all day and I wanted something social to do, and it was either I would go sit at the bar and sketch or I could go work there
and make money.
So my first bartending job was a dive bar, and I just...
In New York?
In New York.
Still there?
It's still there.
Okay.
Yeah, I ended up making friends with people in natural wine and getting into that world and working at a natural wine bar after pandemic shut down. And so I guess more generally, but yeah, I was working with Oddfellows doing illustration and murals
for
them.
They were a client.
Yeah, and we just ended
That was a major thing. You did a mural for a retail location?
Yeah, I did. The first piece I did was I did three drawings for one of their shops, and then I ended up doing two larger wall murals, and then I went to Boston because they opened a location there, and I ended up doing a mural there, and that's sort of when the idea of Cherry on Top started.
All right, don't go any further with that. Just a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
When was that? That was a year or two ago?
Yeah, so this was like, I guess a year before shutdown.
When do the magazines start taking your artwork, and when do you start, you know, getting into some of these really nice publications? When is that?
Man, my sense of time is very skewed right now.
Well, we've had a pandemic for 16,
yeah.
18 months.
Yeah.
Did it happen during that?
It was before.
All right, so a couple of years.
Yeah.
You started seeing your work in really cool places, and that's got to help your ego and you know, your recognition, too.
Well, I had these.
All right, so that brings us up to current. All right, so growing up in Vermont... Being in New York, opening a wine bar, those are all very curious things to me. So did Vermont give you like a certain perspective, or that was the reason you got the hell out of there and went to Paris? And if your parents were New Yorkers, they weren't typical Vermonters, so they had to be kind of hip. And if they sent you to like some hippie high school, that means that falls under their sensibilities. So what did they have influences you on you growing up, and what did Vermont do for you? Growing up in Vermont's different than growing up on the Upper West Side.
Oh,
we both know that.
Yeah.
So what effects did those things
have? Yeah, I mean, my parents had a huge effect. They have always been focused on travel. They moved to China when they were younger to teach English. My mom was in the Peace Corps. My dad was a travel agent. So I've always grown up with this sense of like wanting to explore different cultures. And they're both very, very protective, maybe overprotective parents. So I like It's funny because my mom was always like, stay home, don't go to the party. I was a day student at a boarding school, so I lived with my parents.
Well, I don't get that. Like, what did that do? That wasn't socializing you. Didn't matter to her. She sensed it didn't matter to you.
Well, it's just
usually
funny because
when you're not invited to a party, your parents feel as bad as you do.
Yeah.
It's like, how come you didn't get invited?
Well, it's funny because, like, she was so afraid of me doing anything. But then as soon as I was like, I want to move to Paris when I'm 17, she was like, you should go. Like, go get this experience. She could, because it's so important to her.
That's fairly radical, though.
Yeah.
Paris at 17. So she rallied
but
towards the end.
She went to the Peace Corps straight after college. So, for them to allow me to do that was life-changing. I think growing up in Vermont, I was definitely, like, ready to get out of it. But now, thinking about it, I'm so grateful for that because I definitely, like, have this connection to nature and earth and land. That
appreciation.
Yeah, and now, like, being in the wine world, that's where wine comes from. It's not about this trendy New York experience. It's about the farmers and the land. And I grew up, like, milking cows and gardening, and that's what's important to me, and that's why I love it. It's not the cool trends and the cool bars. It's about the storytelling and the people behind it.
So what natural wine, and I hate that category, but guys who are sustainable, regenerative, organic, biodynamic, what they're doing, you have a even bigger appreciation because you grew up in a state and an environment, you know, where it was always around you, which is really nice. Didn't you have a grandmother in New York? Didn't you sort of have a connection? You weren't shut out.
Oh, yeah.
I would guess that you loved seeing her or Doug being in New York. I mean, how did that work out?
Yeah, I mean, I live in my grandparents' old apartment still, which is where my mom grew up, and it's in the Lower East Side.
That apartment that your grandparents have is where they raised your mom?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so
yeah,
like
there's still scribbles underneath the table that my mom did when she was 2 years old.
Really? That's so cool.
Yeah, that definitely played a part in a lot of my artwork. My whole thesis collection and fashion was based on my grandfather's wardrobe. It was like,
describe that to me. Well, why are you even bringing that up?
It's just, it's impacted everything. The color scheme for Cherry on Top is also based on that.
But was he sort of this outwardly dressing type guy?
They were both characters. My grandmother was a big shopper, and she always bought him suits, and he didn't wear them all. But when I moved in, the closets were just full of all these, like, amazing vintage suits. And, I found old Givenchy wool three-piece and pinstripe and seersucker and just, like, every possible.
That stuff seems more interesting than just, like, the type of Tom Brown straight navy suits now.
Yeah, it's a lot of character.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's pretty cool. So that was a nice connection. Did you go to New York a lot?
I did. I mean, we visited.
As you got older, I guess, did you go on your own more?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, like, every big holiday we spent with my grandparents until they passed away. And I ended up interning in New York in high school for Diane von Furstenberg. So I was staying in the apartment with my grandfather at the time, which is the first time I spent a good amount of time by myself in the city. It's interesting, like, thinking about it in different chapters of my life. 'Cause as a kid, it was like, we would go to Macy's during Christmas time and New York stuff.
But it was a good wraparound to everything else.
Yeah.
Being in Vermont.
Yeah, it was always very exciting to, like, go to the big city. We'd go to Broadway. We'd eat at the restaurant in the Twin Towers for, like, every New Year's.
Windows on the World?
Windows on the World.
Really?
I would wear my, like, little white velvet dress that I loved.
You don't still have it, do you?
I don't think so. No.
You got your grandfather's suits, but not the little white velvet dress.
Not the dress.
That's pretty cool. So New York had a pretty good influence. Let's talk about your work a little, because you kind of guided us along about
when you started drawing, how and what you did. I looked at a lot of your work, and to me, it has an emotion. There's definitely a humor to it, visually and in some of the writing parts, and definitely a satire. There's also, and you said this before, but I wrote it down in my notes, there's a connection between the words and the images. You know, sometimes it's too obvious, other times, like, what's going on here? With you, I mean, I think that's an important part. So this is not a question I love to ask. It's very broad. That's why I don't like to ask it. But you did a little, but let's describe your work. Let's talk about some of the mediums and where some of the inspirations came from. And you did talk about it a little. I mean, just looking in your grandfather's closet was an inspiration. Yeah. But if people's eyes are closed and they've never seen your stuff like I have, I mean, talk to me about, you know, what the work is, where it is now, you know, where it came from.
Yeah, I mean, I think going to fashion school was definitely a big influence. I love doing portraits. I started out doing portraits and a lot of line drawings. I've always loved the movement of lines. And
when you say I love the movement of lines, I should know this, but there is artists that influenced you. Were there, you know, that you look back to that relate to, like, who?
I mean, the whole, like, surrealist movement, Dali, and then Egon Schiele was a big
chosen influence.
And yeah, and then a lot of children's book authors and illustrators,
like the Shel Silversteins and all the illustrations.
Lundsteig, yeah.
When you drew portraits, did people say, "Wow, these are great," or did they say, "What is this? Who is that?" I mean, did you feel like you had it?
I think when I started drawing and posting things on social media, I went through this phase of doing, like, imagined portraits, people that just came to my head, and then I would write these captions that were a little snippet about them that came from nowhere. And I think that sort of got some people's attention because it didn't make any sense.
Right. And they're like, that works.
Like, this is funny, but I don't know what's going on.
Right, but that works.
Yeah.
That
so that's sort of how I started. And I still love just imagination. I think it plays a big part in everything I do, is just, like, having fun with things and even taking on more serious subjects, but having a sense of humor about it. And with my portraits too, they're obviously not realistic. They're very sort of exaggerated, and that's sort of something I developed in art school. I had this teacher I had a drawing teacher who, at one point, I remember we were doing figure drawing, and he was like, "Do whatever you want, whatever comes to your head." So I was doing these distorted sort of figures with stippling and different colors, and he just walks
what
up to
me. What is stippling?
Like dots. Oh, like, okay. Shading with dots.
Right. Is that like Roy Lichtenstein?
No, that's different. That's like a pop art thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like more pointillism.
Right.
Which I was very into back then. But yeah, he just walked up and stood behind me and just, like, looked at me and looked at the page and just, like, had this sort of furrowed brow. And I was like, "What?" He's like, "It's like, you're really weird." And I was like, "Thank you." He's like, "I mean, it's better than me calling you normal." I'm like, That's true.
I think so.
But he was a big influence. And
well, he kind of let you go.
Yeah, I think all my teachers in Paris were very open and just sort of, they taught more how to bring out the most creative version of yourself and not necessarily, like, we learned technique, but it was also about driving force. And
do you think being in Paris versus, let's say, New York City, you know, had an effect, maybe a discernible or positive effect?
know, being there.
I think it, I mean, it, I would be a completely different person if I didn't move there. I think the whole lifestyle, the whole culture, I don't think I would be into wine if I didn't move there.
Okay.
I think the whole cafe culture and sitting around with friends and talking about actual subjects and philosophy and art and that sort of mindset of
so
you
Paris.
Don't need a plan. It's very like whatever happens, happens. And
less stressful about it.
Yeah,
less
it's
intense.
Not super scheduled.
Yeah.
I think New York is very...
Yeah.
Everyone has a plan. Everyone has a schedule, a sense
good,
of time.
It's a good time for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I love not knowing what's going to happen. That's... When I was working
as
a copywriter at a desk job, I mean, it's still scary, but I'd rather not know than know every second of my entire life and be stuck in a job that I don't like and know exactly
I like that,
what I'm gonna...
and if you can handle it. Go back to the art for a second. Mm-hmm. So you did portraits, you did a lot of line drawing illustrations, but you did get into some other mediums. I mean, we did talk earlier about murals.
Yeah.
Jewelry, clothing. I mean, I don't know if that was major, but you did or do it, right?
Well, I love experimenting with new materials, and I've done a lot of watercolor, which is one of my favorite mediums. Fashion clothing I've been doing since I was in high school, and just working with fabric, I still love. But yeah, I think I started out in line drawings. I did a lot of painting. I did a few gallery shows in New York, and then I wanted to get into cartoons because The New Yorker was like the ultimate goal for
you
me.
You did it.
And took a while, but yeah, I.
So are you on their list? Like, is it they rule the world and they'll let you know, or because you've been there and have some type of relationship that you could submit stuff or stay in touch, or they come to you? I mean, how's that work? Wouldn't you love to have another illustration coming up? Like,
oh yeah, I mean, you can submit to them anytime. So all of the work I've done for them, besides one panel cartoon, has been a Shouts piece, which it's funny, I actually got in touch with them because I was making these little anti-Trump pins during the first election, and I was selling them through Instagram, and one of their cartoonists who's done a lot for them reached out and asked me about merchandising, asked if we could have a call, and I was like, if we can have a call about being a New Yorker cartoonist. And he ended up telling me they do open calls every week. You can just come bring work and show the editor, which is like very unique. There's very few publications that you can just show up and have a meeting.
Is that like old school or that's, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't do that way. Everything's digital, send it.
Yeah. But you can go meet with the editor every week.
How quickly after you did that, did they come to you and say, let's do this?
I mean, that first meeting did not go very well. It wasn't a disaster. It was the last week that the old editor was there, and he definitely was not in a good mood. The cartoonist, she went in before me to meet with him, who had been there many times.
That's not fair that you walk into like a crap situation.
He came out crying. Yeah, I was
the guy before you came out crying.
The guy before me came out crying, and I didn't know the format. I just brought a bunch of random papers. I was ready to show that weren't necessarily cartoons, but I just come in. I'm like, here's my work, and he looked through everything, picked up a couple, laughed, and then. And then at the end, he said, so is your style a choice or a limitation?
Good question.
And of course, I was like, it's a choice. And obviously, like, I can adjust my style. And I left he told me, he didn't take anything. He said, clean it up, come back. Which in my head was like, he hates it. And then I called my friend and they were like, you know what? He told you to come back. Like for the editor of The New Yorker to say, come back. It's not.
He knows how to not say that.
Yeah. And so I never went back, but I did send things in digitally when Emma, the new editor, took over. And the first piece was I was just sitting in Tompkins Park sketching people, and it just popped into my head to do a, like, people watcher's guide for New York City parks, and that was the first piece they took. And yeah, and then I was just pitching.
Nice. Do you feel that you could or should be a little more aggressive about submitting work or keeping in touch? Is it on you, or you're doing that and they're not picking it?
I mean, at
this point,
sound
like your dad now.
Yeah, I would like to. For a while, I was sending in panel submissions every week, which is it's a lot to think of 10 panels a week.
It's work.
And now that I have the bar, it's harder to find time to do that, but
yeah,
I do want to.
I mean, you'll find the time.
Yeah.
I was just curious because, you know, it's hard to avoid this question with guests for the last almost 2 years, and it's, you know, how did the pandemic affect your life and work? We're going to talk about the wine bar. Mm-hmm. Did it delay that? Did it create that? Didn't you have plans of traveling abroad that may have changed what you were doing now if you did it? I mean, what were the major effects on the pandemic, good and bad?
Yeah, I mean, we had planned to open before. We actually opened our bank account the day before everything shut down, and we were planning on starting construction. So that all got delayed, but we were originally just going to open the indoor, the downstairs section, and focus on the roof next summer. And then with the pandemic, we decided we need to open the rooftop, which I'm glad we did. I think that has been a big difference, and definitely.
So delay was the major.
Delay.
And the environment that people weren't
and it was,
doing
I mean,
much.
Yeah, we were in the process of finding investors at that point, and that's like,
people
to ask people for money for a bar during a pandemic was not easy.
No.
I was also supposed to go to Paris for like a little inspiration trip right before around March when I could have gone, but probably would have gotten stuck there. Yeah, that didn't happen.
So typical in a lot of ways, you know, just what the pandemic did affected, you know, your plans. We have to take a break first. And when we come back, I want to talk about, we've been cryptically talking about rooftop bars, and I want to talk very specifically, and, you know, we've mentioned the name, but we'll get very much into it. You broached this subject, I think, when you said you started bartending, but what was that point? Was that the point where you recognized wine, and was it natural wine, or was wine, and then you realized natural wine was a thing? When did that happen? Was that the bartending thing and it evolved after that?
Because
you said you didn't drink much wine before that, right?
I drink wine anyone in their early 20s drink wine, but...
So when was that kind of passed through the portal?
I think I ended up... I made friends with another wine bar owner and ended up spending a lot of time with her and going to a lot of tastings. And I think seeing that part of it, the behind the scenes part and the industry, got me interested in it. And just like realizing how each bottle is different and each story is different, and what goes into making the wine.
That captured your attention.
Yeah, it was the storytelling for me.
That sort of is the top answer. Yeah. I mean, it's more than a bottle and a liquid. It's not even the grape. It's the people and the farm and all of that, and, you know, how they do that. The bar you were working at, was it a wine bar-ish place or a dive bar-ish?
The first bar I worked at was Home Sweet Home.
Okay.
So definitely...
Dive.
But then I was working at this like beer bar for a while, and then last summer after COVID, I ended up working at Sauced in Brooklyn, which is wine bar, natural wine bar.
Yeah.
And that definitely taught me a lot.
Yeah.
I had been planning on opening Cherry on Top before that. But that was when I really started learning.
So it happened fairly recently and pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Cerise Elenitz. Everything we talked about up until now, we will tie together. We will talk about Cerise's new wine bar in Bushwick, right around the corner. What's going on there? What kind of wines? She actually brought in a wine, a special cuvée they made, which we're going to taste later. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. In Wisconsin, cheese is our thing. Wisconsin is the only state in the country that requires a license to make cheese. From curds to cheddar, blue to brick, Wisconsin cheesemakers can do it all. We blend tradition with innovation to create an incredible variety of cheeses that you just can't get anywhere else. You've heard of a PhD, but have you heard of a PH cheese? Otherwise known as the Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker Program. This rigorous study of cheese is an elite accomplishment earned by only 80 talented cheesemakers in Wisconsin, and the program is only one of two in the world. Becoming a master cheesemaker takes 13 years and is basically like a doctorate in a specific variety of cheese, with intense requirements to succeed. Our Master Cheesemaker program allows makers to perfect both the art and science of their craft in a tradition so rich you can taste it. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Cerise Elenitz, Vermont born, now New Yorker, illustrator, artist, talk about her book later, but now a wine, natural wine bar open, owner. So we talked about before the break how you got into it. Was this something burning in you? Was this an idea like, hey, I should do it? Not like I got to, but I should do this, or this would be fun or cool. I mean, tell me how the early ideas of, we will now reveal, even though we did Cherry on Top, which is your wine bar. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that.
So it started when I went to Boston with the owner of Oddfellows, and he's into natural wine. We ended up, I was working on this mural, and then we went to this wine bar after, and we're just talking about doing something near their factory so they could have a space to drink. And in my head, I thought they wanted to open it and I would help design it. And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. Came back to New York and he was like, okay, so you need your business plan, you need your investors. And I was like, oh, so this is my project. And
wow. At
that point, I was like, why not? The idea of creating a space is always something I've been wanting to do, breaking out of 2D medium. And I've done a little bit of product design, furniture design, just tying everything together and creating somewhere for people to.
What was the most sort of unnerving thing, like the business plan, the business part of it? I mean, the concept you kind of saw floating around in your head?
Yeah, the concept came pretty quickly. The name, I just woke up in the middle of the night and I was like, oh, this is it.
All right, so I was going to ask you this later on, but let's talk about the name. So the wine bar is called Cherry on Top. It's about a month old. It's in Brooklyn. It's gotten a lot of good notices. That's how I found out about Cerise and the wine bar. So Cerise and Cherry. So how did you get the name Cherry on Top?
For a while, I was thinking of using a French name, playing with bad translations, which is something I...
Like something bistro, but funny and
I was
cryptic.
Thinking Cerise sur le toit, which is Cerise on the roof directly, okay. Which doesn't make sense. But then, I mean, the fact that it used to be an ice cream factory, and there's a rooftop, and my name translates to cherry in French. It all just sort of fit together, cherry on top. And the color is red and white and green. I wanted to use green and white because it's the wallpaper in my apartment my grandmother put in the 50s.
All these, like, little inspirations detail, yeah. And things you've been staring at most of your life.
So it all just fit together. And I used to, when I was like 5 years old, I used to sign my name as this distorted double cherry. So that became the logo.
Very cool. So there's like
there's a lot of personal history. Yeah.
Go back for a second, because earlier we talked about you were, you know, you're an illustrator, artist. You did work for Oddfellows. Who's the guy? Amir Nathan? Is he your...
Amir is my operations partner. He
Who was the Oddfellows guy?
Mohan Kumar.
Mohan. Yeah. So Mohan played a big part in really, in a lot of ways, the physical structure, the inspiration, dumping the challenge on you. And maybe you were scared, but it seemed like it never unnerved you.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky in having him because he's done this so many times and he helped with the whole business plan, with the projections. There's no way I would have done this without
a business guy who opened and ran businesses.
Yeah.
So that's like a mentor. That's like a good thing.
No, he's been great in the fact that he was like, you can do this. He believed in me.
So you're about a month into it. Were the bumps in the road manageable, or forget the pandemic for a minute? I mean, is everything manageable? It's like, okay, this happens. I could deal with it, or things are going fine.
I also have a great operations partner who's taken on a lot of the business aspect. And obviously there's bumps. There's always bumps. But
it's
been, we figured it out so far.
So let's talk about the figure out parts. So now we're talking about the wine bar. You obviously had an idea. What was the vision you wanted to execute? A lot of your inspirations, but did Paris play into it? I mean, what were the things that, you know, you wanted to see?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to do something different, first of all. I think...
Different than what?
Different than other New York wine bars. I mean, Paris was a big inspiration. There's so many bars there that I have spent so much time
for, places like that, right?
And like, you just feel at home there and you just want to sit and talk to the bartender and try different things, and it's cozy, it's welcoming. And I think that it's harder to find that in New York. It's a whole different feel, whole different industry.
So that's what you knew you wanted.
That's what I want. I wanted to, make something that's approachable too, and you can learn about wine, ask about wine. You don't feel bad about asking questions. Because I was lucky enough to have friends in the industry, so I got to ask them questions, but it is intimidating walking into some of these bars and you feel like you just have to accept whatever they give you because you don't know what
you're
doing.
It's not supposed to be in the natural wine world, but I think it's easing up a little. The why Bushwick question is because of the Oddfellow existing building. When he talked about his building, did Bushwick make sense? Like, that's a neighborhood and a place?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I moved to New York around 10 years ago, I spent a lot of time in Bushwick and it was a whole different world. But it has changed a lot. The natural wine scene is becoming very apparent in this area, and there's a lot of space. And just the fact of being able to have a rooftop.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Was a big selling point.
Manhattan, that's tough or expensive. Yeah. Was this the opportunity for you to merge important things like wine, art, food? I mean, is this place an example of the convergence of all those things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, it all came together. I think my life has been building up to it in a way. I've always, liked trying different things out and done a lot of different random jobs that don't really seem like they're building to a career, but when this opportunity appeared, it was like, oh, I can use my graphic design skills and my wine knowledge and my love of cooking and storytelling.
So graphic design, you had a heavy hand in it, right? You helped make the bar. I mean, the walls are basically your,
yeah,
not just art, but design.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, my paintings are directly on the walls. I curated the other artwork. I made the menus, did the layout, made the font. All the flyers are mine. The whole social media presence is me. I got to curate the plants with the help of this amazing gardener. Plant
upstairs
selection.
Or?
Yeah, on the roof. We have like every kind of herb. We have.
Do you use them for?
Yeah, we're using them in our menu.
Very cool. Let's talk about the bar and the wine. How much of a hand, or was it you who put the wine list together?
I mean, I do have a wine, technically wine director who...
You guys work together.
We work together. And yeah, I'm very lucky that we have similar tastes and we'll do tastings. And
so then what was your thinking? I think we covered a lot of it. It's natural, which is really... You fill in the blanks. I mean, it's organic, biodynamic, small producers. Give me that whole thing,
yeah,
the stories.
Like, it's not 100% biodynamic. It's,
right, you're not.
That's not really my focus. It's more about unique wines that are well-made, that have stories. And I think my palate has changed a lot since I got into this world. And
Where was the change?
I mean, when I first started liking natural wines, they were like the super barnyardy, funky. And now I'm like, I want really nice classic Chenin and just like,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with, I mean, I still love
some of the funkier.
Yeah, but there's so many ways that can manifest itself. It's not all barnyardy.
No, I know. That was an old argument, you know, that they didn't travel well, or you know, they weren't consistent. Yeah. Yeah, but that's true
with
anything.
But there's so many variation in flavor profiles that I didn't even realize when I got into it. I thought it was either like super earthy or just like super clean. And there's wines that taste like black pepper. There's wines that taste like ocean water. There's wines
like Cabernet Franc's profile is totally different than, you know, a Merlot.
Yeah.
So regionally, does this fall to a heavy Francophile list, or you're not necessarily?
Actually, surprisingly, no. When we started building the list, I picked out way too many Italian wines, and I think I did.
Why do you think?
I mean, I ended up, I did a residency at a vineyard in Italy a couple of years ago, and that was also a life-changing experience. Just being able to see the process of making the wine and the culture. And I think there's...
So when you were in Italy, wine was on your radar. And
yeah.
You realized Italy is as good a country as any.
Yeah,
for,
I mean,
wine, and certainly for the natural wine movement.
Yeah.
They've been doing it as long as anyone.
Yeah, there's a lot of character and history and personality that comes through in Italian wines. Like the... You feel like you're in Italy. There's more emotion. I think it's the way Italians talk to versus the way French people talk. It's
very much so. That's
not as,
I'm starting to
back.
Feel that in Portugal and Spain too, which is nice. All right, so there's you have Italian wines, you have French wines. What else? I mean, what are you trying to do with the list? Is it seasonal? Is it what's available?
It's exploration. There's no
your
focus.
Exploration, right?
My,
I mean, you're living vicariously through this list.
Travel. It's all about travel. I mean, we have wines from Greece. We have wines from Mexico. We have wines from Armenia. We have wines from the U.S. I'm trying to broaden or bring in as
so you're
many.
Open to anything.
Yeah.
Are you worried about price? Like, I don't think it'd do well if it's sold over a certain price point. Do you look for not cheap, not inexpensive, but what's a good value that makes sense to the consumer?
Yeah, I mean, I look for value, but there's honestly so many less expensive wines that are so well made that just people don't know about because they're not the wines that everyone wants, which is sort of what I'm looking for. The more like smaller farmers that don't have big representation and they make very good small batches of wine. And
so to that point, is it hard to get the smaller guys because the production's limited, you know? And now you and I will agree that natural wine is more popular. You're not the first or last place to open up, you know, a bar like this. Can you get what you want, or is it about finding what everyone else isn't doing and trying that? You know, like what's Frank Cornelison, you know, everybody wants that. I mean, is it important to have that or not? I mean, can you get what you want?
I think it's, I mean, it takes more research and more tasting, and it's a lot more involved, I think, than picking the wines that you know will sell that are allocated. And we do have some allocated wines, but I mean, it's not hard to purchase them because they're not.
They're available.
They're available. It just
because you are getting away from that allocated stuff in a way,
yeah.
But you're more interested in them. Are we talking about like the whole importers and distributors that are the big names, or do we start getting into smaller guys? Like we've had Von Boden on the mm-hmm. air and Palinkery and, you know, all these small guys. Are those the guys? A friend of mine just left Grand Cru and he started a smaller. Mm-hmm. Are those the guys that have the wines or every?
I mean, I've been tasting with bigger reps, smaller reps. Like if a rep I've never heard of wants to do tasting, I'm usually open to it. But within bigger books, there are also winemakers that like you wouldn't see on a list in a trendy wine bar that I'm interested in. Yeah, it takes more time to wade through everything, and but I'm working with bigger books, smaller books.
So when you walk in there, it's more about how you curate it and that you're open to anything. I mean, you have a direction and a vision,
mm-hmm.
smaller producers, stories and all that, but you're not looking for allocations. So people really, they come in and they should be open to anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try, don't ask for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to satisfy every category of wine,
yeah.
and have well, something
you'll feel
that everyone
out
will
and
like.
Learn that, I guess.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's nice, the more time we are open, the more we see where we need to see where the gaps are. And
yeah, you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are like, I get it, but it's not what I want.
Yeah, exactly.
You
got to
have
something.
No, you're right.
I know that my taste isn't what everyone wants
yeah,
to drink all the
you
time.
You can't open a store entirely on your taste.
Exactly, yeah.
What about food? You doing light food?
Yeah, we have a snack menu we just updated for fall. One of my partners is a chef, so he worked with me on the menu, and it's also based on travel and just that idea of the Parisian wine bar where you can go and have snacks but feel like you've actually eaten, and it's not just...
You could call it a meal and a few drinks,
yeah.
other than I had a snack, where do I eat now?
Exactly.
You
could leave being satisfied, not feeling like you...
So... There's a recognition of the food and the wine and the food,
mm-hmm.
right? So the snacks complement.
Yeah.
They're built that way.
Yeah, it's definitely very important to me. Also, one of my big requirements was that we have a free snack that you get When you sit down and get a glass, they'll push a bowl of... We got olives. We have olives right now. We might change it at some point, but it's just the...
Something to nibble.
Something to and make you feel welcome. I think it's important. It's small, but nowhere in New York really does that. Just like a little welcome, like have a seat. Here's a snack. Hospitality, it just makes you feel at home a little more.
I like
that. And then the snack menu, it's all twists on things, and we have like a beetroot pickled egg that's topped with aioli and this bonito crispy shallot mixture that we came up with. And
so typical of you, it's not traditional.
Yeah.
You see things a certain way, and that's how you want to present it. All right, so the name of the bar is called Cherry on Top. It is in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Cerise, what is the exact address?
379 Saddam Street.
379 Saddam. You can go in and sit inside, or you can go upstairs and sit on the bar. Snacks, food, interesting wines, small producers, nice lean towards natural, type wines. last question, by the glass you have, important? By the glass program?
Yeah.
I mean, are there wines that are by the glass that are not available, by the bottle? I mean, do you
We have everything certain? By the glass.
Is available?
Is available by the bottle, okay. But we try and keep that rotating pretty consistently so people can try new wines by the glass.
So what's the thinking? You get the wines and then, we'll put these by the glass. Or do you say these are good by the glass? And, of course, we'll make them available. I mean, because some people's by the glass programs, there's not a lot of thought put into it. And others are substantial,
Oh, definitely. I mean, right now we just have a couple of each color by the glass. But we definitely think about if it's stable, if it will open up over time, if we have a few in each category, how they differ from each other. We want to keep it, we don't want two whites to be the same. We want you to be able to try different things and keep it interesting.
Yeah. You're a wine guy that's helping you. Where did he or she come from?
He's a friend. Right now he works with Wild Air and Ultra Paradiso. So he's had a lot of experience in this.
My friend Jorge came out of there, and then Sam Anderson was there. Mm. Good people. They're very focused on wine, which is a nice thing. All right. Is it fair to say you fulfilled one of your goals by writing a book about subject matter that you like? Didn't you write a book recently?
Yeah, I've been writing it.
The Sound of Scrambled Eggs is what? Sort of a compilation of all these thoughts and short stories.
It's a compilation of short stories based on food memories and spans from my childhood to more recently when I think the last story was New York, but after my time in Paris. And
are some of these stories 8, 10, 12, 20 years old?
Yeah. Yeah,
the first one is sort of a diary in a way.
Yeah, first one is.
Is there a pattern the way you set it up? Is it chronological?
It's chronological. I played around with the formatting a lot, but decided in the end to do it chronologically. At first, I didn't even do it in the first person because I was like, "Oh, it's kind of about me," and then.
It is about me.
It is about me. Yeah. It's about me. I can't pretend it's not.
Yeah. I would guess. I haven't seen it. Normally I do, but everything happens so quick. I would gather there's a lot of illustrations in there.
There's each story has a little illustration. It's very I wanted to keep it simple formatting, and it's about 50 pages long. I did the cover design, got it printed in Tribeca, so it's printed in New York.
Where do we find it?
It's at the bar.
Okay. So that's
and also on my website.
Okay. So The Sound of Scrambled Eggs, Cerise's book, stop by the bar and pick one up or go to her website, which is fun anyway. Fun in a good way. All right. Nobody leaves the studio alive without answering our wine list. five questions that we pose to everyone, the same five questions for the past 4 or 5 years and 200 guests. Spontaneous, don't dwell on these answers. Don't overthink them. Please be scared, because I want those adrenaline answers, okay? This is easy, don't worry about it. All right, so first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you tasting for the wine bar? What's caught your attention? Did the change of seasons bring certain wines in? Give me a few examples of what's in your fridge with all that kale.
But, man, I
You can't stumble on this.
I know. I keep thinking about the new beachy wine that some people love, some people hate, but that's like that smoky red.
Wait, is the maker beachy?
Beachy, yeah.
B-I-C-I?
B-I-C-H-I.
Oh, beachy. Okay.
From Mexico.
My bad. Right.
It's one of my favorite winemakers. They make these super smoky.
Is that, what's that peninsula called? Is it made, you know, south of California on that peninsula? Oh. Or is it made... Can't believe I'm blanking.
It's Tecate.
Is it Tecate?
I think it's Tecate.
Okay. So a Biche Red?
Biche Red. They have a new cuvée Mystico that I love. What else?
What else? Give me one other one. You're struggling worse than anyone I can remember in the last two.
No, you mean it. There's too many. It's so hard.
Anything at the wine bar that's like, whoa, give me another.
All of them. Well, the Helios is super cool.
Helios? Is that one of the Greeks?
Greek, yeah. It white has this, or like, red? Rose water. It's white. Very, like, elegant. Has a hint of, like, rose water. And
is it... I'm not saying this because you're using the word rose, but is it a white wine, or is it almost a white rosé-ish?
Skin contact. It's white.
It's a skin contact white?
No, it's not skin contact. Yeah.
Okay, it's kind of this elegant, kind of cool wine.
Yeah.
All right, those are good.
I could go on, but...
Well, if you think of anything, throw it in. All right, you love food. You grew up around food. Favorite wine and food pairing? Something you don't necessarily eat all the time, but something that has a little history with you that is just like, oh yeah, this is it.
Oh, history. I mean, immediately I just thought of the pop-up we did the other week with Dina and Q, two chefs from Racine's and Wild Air, and they made this mussel toast with saffron aioli that I paired with this Maldición Spanish skin contact that has this, like, it's a Malvar grape, so it has this, like, sherry caramel quality, and that was, like, the perfect pairing.
Is the sherry a little nutty? That
has
aspect,
like, yeah,
of it?
Nutty caramel.
So it's a mussel toast, which is a marinated mussel.
Escabeche.
And then the wine was, did you tell me something specific? Or
Maldición.
That's the maker?
That's the cuvée name.
Let's spell that. Do we know how to spell that?
Maldición.
Okay.
Maldición.
And the grape?
Malvar. Malvar.
And from Spain?
From Spain.
Okay. I'll be glad to tell you. Nobody's ever given me that answer before. So you did good.
It's a new one.
All right. Obviously, there's been a pandemic. You've been caught up with your own venture. But do you have a favorite wine restaurant or bar in the East Village, out here in Manhattan? Is there a place? Like, I think I would go into Cherry on Top and go, yes. They kind of know what they're doing. Not kind of. They know what they want to do with the wine list. The vibe is great. They come over. They know what they're talking. This is a cool thing. What, anything like that to you?
I mean, my hangout is 10 Bells in Lower East Side.
There's one in Bushwick,
and
now
in Bushwick because it's so close. But the
is
one
it
in
anywhere
Lower
near
Side,
your place?
It's a few blocks away.
Is it?
Yeah.
Look at Bushwick. It's becoming a... Else maybe opening something.
Yeah.
I forgot what, and I don't know if you saw it, but who cares? We love people doing the same thing. All right, so 10 Bells. Anything else like that, or we go with 10 Bells?
I mean, there's a bunch in New York, or in... Anywhere. If we're in Paris, then I have...
Give me your favorite Paris.
And Martin is one of my favorites.
What's it called?
Martin.
Martin.
The Les Enfants de Marche and the Marché des Enfants Rouges. little seafood bar. That's one of my favorite. Yes. Marie Celeste, my friend owns it. I actually did illustration for them. Where else? I mean,
those are good.
Paris, I could.
Those are good. A couple weeks ago, I had a woman named Rachel Signer on. Hmm. Rachel wrote a book about being in Paris and then meeting a natural winemaker and now raising a girl in Australia. But she very much was embedded in that scene that was important, that I sensed the same feel from you, you know, that these places were. And Paris was definitely a natural wine bar bastion early on. All right. Fourth question. Oh, boy, this could be trouble for you, but you'll figure it out. Favorite all-time wine. The question originally was posed, Cerise, what is the most expensive rare wine you ever had? Who cares? What's the wine? And think back to the interview of different times. What's the wine that was a gateway wine that was significant, that made an impression on you? Is there a wine or two out there that's just important to you?
It's funny because the gateway wine and also the most expensive wine, I have one friend who got me into natural wine, and he introduced me to Clos Fontaine Fougere, which was like the first natural wine that I was
F-O-N-T-I-N-E?
F-A-N-T-I-N-E.
F-A-U-G-E-R-E-S, Fougere.
Yeah, Fougere. Yeah. And that was the first.
That made an impression on
me. That made an impression, but the other night he came into the bar, and we have this bottle, we have two bottles of it, the Oulamp. It's hand-blown glass bottle, handmade cork, beautiful.
What is it?
100% Morved from Languedoc. We opened a bottle, and that was one of the most expensive natural wines I've had, and it was the same friend, so...
Wait, did you say what it was?
100% Morved.
That's what it's called?
No, it's called Oulamp.
Spell.
U-L-L-A-M-P.
You did say that. The name of the donkey. I didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's...
Okay.
But
so that stood out.
Two of the coolest wines.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Same friend. Yeah.
Those are good ones. I haven't mentioned this yet, but we post all your answers on social media. And like every other guest that preceded you, we have a database. You could go back to Instagram all the way back and look at everyone. All right, final question, and you should be able to answer this because you're in the biz. And the question is, give me your recommendations for best wine around 15, 20 bucks retail. And the setup always is, I have kids in their 20s. They're adults now. They can't show up at a party with a crappy supermarket wine or give a gift. Mm-hmm. They sort of can't afford 45, 50 bucks. So how do you impress and woo for 15, 20, 22 bucks? Give me a red, give me a white. You could do category like Muscadet's cheap and good. But what do you got?
I mean, the red we have by the glass now, we have this red Vino Verde that's super cool, very inexpensive.
Can you buy it retail?
I'm sure. I don't know where.
Right,
though.
Think retail. Think accessibility.
So it has to
not
be
Uber accessible. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a second, though.
Let me see.
What are good value wines that you serve?
I haven't bought wine at a wine shop in a long time.
Yeah, but you know what you pay for certain things, and you know the retail and the markup and all that, or the wholesale to the markup, which is your retail.
I mean, still the Clos Fontaine Fougere is that, around 20-30.
Okay, maybe so I'm going to put that down.
It's a great wine. What else is accessible?
Like, you may or may not like Muscadet, but it's not expensive. And with a good maker, it's a good, something like that. I mean, is there anything, red or white that falls in those categories additionally?
I mean, I think there's like, I think a sort of typical Vino Verde, classic Portuguese.
Yes.
Or Pepino, Chilean, usually pretty cool. Actually, Pepino is a good one.
Now you're thinking. All right, we'll go with those. But I'm going to haunt you and pester you.
I'm going to keep thinking of answers. I want to follow up on that question.
I'm going to text you or something and say, now that you've thought about it. All right, those are good answers. Very good. Not to make you feel. You were more than good on those. All right, we wrap up the show every week with a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip, where I ask my guests to bring in a bottle of wine that reflects who or what they are. You have a wine bar. I said, Cerise, bring something in that's sort of a reflection of your thinking and what you're serving there. And to my delight, it went even further. There's a winemaker named Zwick, Joe Zwick. You've done some work for him with his labels, but you and him collaborated on a cuvée that you serve by the bottle and the glass there. Is it by the glass too?
Yeah, we have it by the glass
too. All right, so take it away. Describe to me the wine, when it was made, the blend, and then we're going to evaluate it. So and I'm getting up to get more.
I actually went to his vineyard this spring and got to taste through all of his barrels and pick the grapes that I thought would work the best in this blend, and came up with this sort of unique, sort of bizarre combo of Cinsault, biodynamic Nebbiolo, and Malbec Rosé. And they were each very specific to me. I tasted the Cinsault and had this feeling of Vermont nostalgia and like sawdust.
Just the Cinsault straight up?
Yeah, the Cinsault, okay. And then the Nebbiolo.
So you said that could be an element of...
Yeah. I had to taste through everything twice to decide on the three, but the Malbec Rosé had this very sort of light, buttery quality that reminded me more of the Paris element, and then the Nebbiolo was this sort of, it was biodynamic, so it was like a little effervescent, a little more barnyardy, and I think together it just turned into this really cool light red with notes of cherry, but also this like
there's a cherry on the label and
earthy.
I don't get the sawdust, but I get the earthy. All right, so it is the Cerise, what do we call it? It is the cherry on top
sweet cuvée. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's do an evaluation, you and me together. So the first thing is color. It's kind of got that translucent dark pink red, nice color. It's doesn't look filtered. You know, it's not clear.
Yeah.
Doesn't, I love that. All right, I'm going to throw this to you. What do you get on the nose? You said a few things already.
I mean, yeah, it definitely has more of a woody, earthy thing to me.
Does any one of the three grapes stand out to you more than the other?
I think right now I'm smelling more of the Nebbiolo.
That's the kind of earthy,
yeah,
you know, that,
yeah,
Nebbiolo and Barolo has that. All right, let's take a sip, throw it over the tongue. Let's talk about mouthfeel for a second. So it's got a medium mouthfeel. It's not unctuous, which I like. It's not thin. Feels good going down. I'd say medium. All right, now taste. Do the descriptors we talked about on the nose reflect in the taste? What do you get on the taste?
I mean, it definitely keeps that earthy nose, but there's more cherry, red fruit.
There is that red fruit. The fruit's prominent, and you would lean towards cherry, maybe not so much raspberry, maybe strawberry, something not sweet. A little more tart than
it's
sweet,
tart,
which is cherry. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so this is, when was this bottle?
This was...
I mean, does it have a vintage year?
2020.
Yeah, last September.
Yeah, 2020.
Yeah, so this is the 2020 Cherry on Top Red Blend Cuvée. Made by Cerise and Zwick. This is an incentive and a motivation for you to go into the wine bar and taste it, because it's pretty much nowhere else.
Can't get it anywhere else.
Nope. Would you reveal what I'm paying for a glass for this? About?
This is 18 by the glass.
Okay.
So it's pretty good. More expensive.
Yeah. So there are wines that are less.
Oh, yeah. Most of our wines
are. This is a unique, limited, you know, cuvée.
Limited. Collaboration.
You're allowed to do that.
Artistic.
All right. Very good. I love it. It's my kind of wine. Seriously.
Good.
Like Guy Fieri said on Driver's Diary, if you don't like it, shut up. You know, if you like it, you talk about it. I like it. You know, it's my kind of wine. I get it. It's definitely a chillable red. I would drink it a little chilled. So that's terrific, and thank you for bringing it in. All right, Cerise, like I told you, we're running late. We got to wrap up. Let me do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Wherever you do get your pods, just hit the subscribe button. You know, as I've been saying the past few weeks, you wake up and there's Cerise's interview waiting for you to be heard. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. But you could always connect those dots by going to the hashtag TheGrapeNation. As I said, we will post Cerise's wine list, all those answers. And we will post specifics on the weekly wine sip, the terrific cuvée we tasted, on our social media sites. Cerise, two things. If we want to follow you, and if you're me, I would want to follow you. So if you're my listeners, you would want to follow you. And where can we find more about Cherry on Top?
Cherry on Top, we have our Instagram. It's at cherry.on.top. NYC.
But I think if you went to the thing and put Cherry on Top, I did.
You would
come
find
right
it,
up.
Yeah.
So Cherry on Top on Instagram.
And we also NYC have our website. Website, cherryontopnyc.com.
Which shows a lot of your artwork. It's very sort of a home page for all the stuff you're doing, too.
Yeah, well, that's Cherry on Top. My personal website is ceriselenetz.com.
Okay, Z-E-L-E-N-T-Z.
E-T-Z.
Right, E-T-Z. Did I not say that?
Yeah, no.
What did I say?
Z-E-L-E-N-T-Z.
All right, say it again.
Happens a lot.
Come on. Happens a lot. This is what I'm doing. I should get it right.
I know. I mean, people never spell my name right, so.
Z-E-L-E-N-E-T-Z. That's right.
Yeah.
Zelenetz. Right.
Yeah.
All right, so that's your website, the Cherry on Top website.
Instagram.
Your personal Instagram?
Is Unnecessary Observations.
Explain that to me while I have you here.
It just stuck.
It did?
I think.
When did you start Instagram?
Since the beginning.
How long ago was that?
Like 6 years ago.
Okay,
and
so it's been around for a while. All right, so that's where you could find all the skinny on Cerise. Before we go, I just want to tell you about some friends events. Natural Wine Devotees rejoice because on Monday, November 1st, at Strong Rope Brewery on the waterfront in Red Hook, Brooklyn, Wild World, the Natural Wine and Fermented Festival, returns after a hiatus in 2020, an opportunity to taste wine, cider, beer, and fermented foods from around the country and the world. Tickets are available at www.wildworldfestival.com. And if that ain't enough, the Saturday before, on October 30th, Chef Zach Palacio and sommelier Lila Holland are bringing back their Hudson Valley Natural Wine Festival, Peripheral, this year. Peripheral will be held at Kitty's in Hudson, New York, pretty much of a hotspot for food and wine, which is across from the Amtrak station in upstate New York. Tickets are on sale now at www.peripheralwine.com. So those are two cool events. Maybe you should go to one of those.
I'll be at Wild Wine.
Yeah. Thank you to our guests, Cerise Zelenetz. Thank you for coming in and telling us all the exciting stuff. Thanks to our engineer, Liam, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.